Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another book on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today to be interviewing Dr. Richard Thompson Ford about his fascinating book titled Dress Codes, How the Laws of Fashion Made History, published by Simon & Schuster in 2021. This is, kind of as the title states, about the history of the laws of fashion, but that definitely does not do justice to the really cool things that are in this book, exploring how clothing is about identity and status, how that's changed over the centuries, how we get to today's ideas of menswear and womenswear, the politics and the law that are wrapped up in all of these things that maybe we sometimes take for granted. So, Richard, I'm so pleased to welcome you to the podcast to tell us about your book.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Before we dive into the many fascinating aspects of the book, though, could you maybe start us off with a bit of an introduction of yourself and explaining how you got to this book?
Sure. So I'm a law professor, and among the things I teach are civil rights, anti-discrimination law. I also teach a local government course that's about urbanism and the history and importance of cities and urban development. And those topics got me interested in two things. One is a look at the importance of culture, popular culture in everyday life, the way law affects everyday life. Because typically, when people think about legal theory, they think about big constitutional law cases, you know, big momentous cases that change our understanding of, let's say, human rights. But I'm interested in the way law affects everyday life and smaller things that people may not notice. Also, in the context of anti-discrimination law and civil rights, a surprising number of cases involved dress codes in one way or another, disputes over rules about what people could wear, gendered dress codes that some men and women would resist, dress codes that regulated grooming and hairstyles that some, for instance, African Americans would resist, dress codes that prohibited natural hairstyles or hairstyles that were suitable to the texture of African American hair. Lots of cases about dress codes, religious dress codes, high school students resisting dress codes and asserting their rights to freedom of expression. And all of these cases, one of the things that struck me about these cases was that the courts didn't do a very good job, in my view, in understanding what was really at stake in these cases about dress codes. They tended to look at dress and fashion as trivial. And sometimes the courts would even say, well, obviously this is trivial, except for the fact that it might affect some more important thing like the freedom of expression or race discrimination, for instance. And I thought that was wrong, that people weren't fighting and risking getting kicked out of school or losing their jobs over something that was trivial. And so I wanted to explore the history of rules and regulations about dress to get a sense of what was really at stake, why everyone was fighting over this in a context where at the same time that people were fighting over it, they were also always saying, well, it's trivial.
That's a very good sort of set of questions and curiosities that I can see really drove this book, which kind of leads to the sort of obvious question of, if everyone's talking about this, or a lot of people are talking about this in terms of triviality, why then are there so many rules? If it's trivial, why bother putting all these rules into place at all?
Yes, exactly. That's the question that I wanted to answer. And what was useful to me was to go back in history to a period of time where people were more explicit about why they were regulating dress. Because in today's environment, everyone says it's trivial, although we still all care about it. So when you go back in history, you find that clothing is a way of expressing social status and identity and group membership. And it becomes a very important way for people to kind of construct a persona that's visible and that's legible in a social sphere. So when you go back to, for instance, Tudor era England, there are elaborate sumptuary laws and what were called acts of apparel. And they were designed to regulate what people could wear according to their social status. So, you know, the kind of stereotypical version is only the king can wear ermine or crimson velvet. But they were much more elaborate than that. They would have great details and gradations of who could wear what. And those laws sometimes would tell you in a preamble why they were passing the law. And so one, for instance, said, because of great confusion as to the, I'm paraphrasing, but great confusion as to the identification of persons according to their titles, eminences, and degrees, causing great disorder in the realm, we pass this act of apparel. So they were quite upfront about saying the issue was you can't tell who's who in the social hierarchy because people are dressing in ways that would suggest a social status that they don't occupy. And that was the first way into getting at to why there are so many rules around clothing, because we're expressing something and people wanted to be sure that what we were expressing was in some sense accurate.
Interesting, because I think we don't always link those things. We don't always go back in history and think about what the impacts might be to today. And that's, I think, one of the powers of the book, is making those links between the history and the sort of ways we think now. And I sort of want to ask about the going back into history, because that's always a really tricky question, right? How far back does one go? And what do you try and do with it? So you've mentioned Tudor England, but the book really begins in the 14th century. How did you pick that? Why is that the starting point?
Yes. Well, when I first started writing the book, I was planning to write a book about the 20th century. But to get answers, I found myself being drawn further back into history. And the 14th century turned out to be a great time to begin the discussion for two related reasons. One is, many historians would describe the late Middle Ages around the 14th century as the birth of modernity, the moment in which a modern sensibility in terms of how people thought about themselves and their relationship to society emerged, the beginning of our own era. In addition, and I don't think this is coincidental, the 14th century is also a period of time in which many fashion historians describe as the birth of fashion. And a few things are happening. One is that tailoring, at least in Europe, is becoming widespread and a technology that's used to create clothing that is not only form-fitting, but also quite expressive, that's able to create kind of sculptured shapes. So you can think of puffy shoulders or large ruffs around the neck or trousers that balloon in various ways. So tailoring is really taking off. Before that, most European attire was draped and both sexes wore draped clothing. But in the 14th century, you begin to get this tailored clothing, but particularly for men. All these innovations early came from men first, but tailored clothing that was quite expressive. So those two things made the 14th century a great period to start. And one of the things that you begin to see in the 14th century is that clothing becomes a way for people to express not only social status as I mentioned before, but also individual identity. So a new ideal of individualism is beginning to come into shape, and fashion not only reflects that individuality, I can now express myself through tailored clothing, but also, I would argue, advances and contributes to the emergence of a modern individualist sensibility.
All right. Those are pretty good reasons to start where you've started. That makes rather a lot of sense. But there's still quite a big gap, obviously, between that time period in terms of what people actually wore and sort of how we think of modern fashion. And in some senses, you know, thinking of the big ruffs of the Tudor period, or thinking of the strange hose, poofy things on their legs that men wore back then, that doesn't exactly scream modern. You know, the other idea of kind of people having like five dresses that they wear for multiple years, people not bathing that often, you know, there's a whole lot of reasons that on the face of it, that doesn't exactly seem to have a whole lot of links to now. So when did modern fashion emerge? And I guess more importantly, what enabled modern fashion to emerge?
Yes. And so when I used the term modern, then, you know, I used it in a kind of specific way, meaning the move from the ancient world to a particular kind of modern sensibility that includes, again, things like individualism, a humanism, and, you know, a different relationship of human beings to society that we probably would say kind of reached a high point in the Enlightenment. But I don't mean modern in the sense of contemporary. So when we're thinking about how we got where we are now, yes, absolutely, a lot of things changed. Technologies continued to advance. And so clothing became much more accessible to a wider range of people. This was particularly true earliest in the United States, where mass-produced clothing, like the Brooks Brothers suit, for instance, made relatively refined clothing available to people from a much greater range of incomes and social status than had been true in the past. And of course, a lot of changes occur in terms of the relationship that people have to government. So the explicit class hierarchies of the old regimes of Europe through become challenged and overturned in many cases through a variety of revolutions. And what then emerges is a Enlightenment sensibility that is at least expressly more egalitarian and more focused on ideals like industriousness and sobriety and rationality. And clothing comes to reflect that. So our clothing is evolving to go along with these political ideals. That's one of the things I want to trace through in the book. And so when you begin with, as you say, the ruffs and the trunk hose and the elaborate clothing, this is a way to signify status in societies that value spectacle, and in which status is a formal attribute. As things move forward, status becomes expressed in much subtler forms, and it's related to, again, Enlightenment ideals like rationality. So the clothing evolves away from sumptuousness and toward a sort of spare, toned-down clothing. And so our modern sense of fashion is driven in a great deal by that. Now I could talk more about the fashion industry. We could talk about that later. But that's an evolution from the early modern period, the 14th century forward, to contemporary times.
We will certainly talk about the current fashion industry a little bit later, but I want to stay on this idea of sort of the evolution during the time period that we're sort of talking about, in this, these ideas of the rationality, efficiency, you know, all of these, sobriety, as you said, of course, happening in the context of things like the Reformation, the Industrial Revolution later on. And I think one of the things that maybe leads us to think of clothing as trivial is we don't always connect them with these kind of high politics events. But of course you do, thankfully, in the book. And one of the ways that that comes out is when you very helpfully explain where tailored clothing comes in, where that idea that we've gone from the trunks and the ruffs and somehow we've ended up with a suit. That doesn't really look like the clearest trajectory. So how does that happen?
Yes. Well, in this late Middle Ages through the Renaissance, status is expressed through kind of flashy clothing. And so when you look at the sumptuary laws, they're a lot about making sure that only elites can wear sumptuous clothing that is expensive, that's flashy, that expresses a certain kind of magnificence. That's what's valued. And meanwhile, you have an emergent skilled artisan and merchant class that's also trying to dress in this very sumptuous and elaborate way. That's one of the reasons that you get these sumptuary laws. Now, when we move forward into history, that expression of magnificence is discredited in many environments. In England, Charles I is executed. There are a variety of political changes and revolutions that discredit the idea of aristocratic magnificence and replace it with, first, a religious ideal of asceticism, and then also a new kind of aristocratic ideal of practicality and sobriety and a certain type of freedom. So, one example I use in the book is there's a moment when this change, what some scholars describe as the great masculine renunciation, the clothing's getting more and more streamlined, and it's starting to look more and more like that three-piece suit. It's not there yet, but it's starting to move in that direction. English gentlemen are wearing something called a frock coat, which is a precursor to the modern suit jacket. And it's not flashy and elaborate, at least not to the same extent. And this English gentleman's about to travels to France, crosses the channel to France. And France is still very much a courtly society with all of the trappings of old world aristocracy. And so as an English aristocrat, he needs to dress in a manner that's befitting an aristocrat in France. And this is what he says. He says, I felt so deprived of my liberty that I felt that I'd been placed in the Bastille, and I longed for my loose little frock coat, for it leaves a man under no great restraint, but allows him to do as he pleases, much as our glorious Constitution. And so I thought that sentence encapsulated the relationship between political idealism and clothing. He had made that link, the frock coat was about freedom and the values of the Enlightenment and a lack of constraint, whereas the aristocratic garb of France was constraining and didn't respect the individual liberties and made him feel as if he was imprisoned. And so as those kinds of changes spread, the values of the Enlightenment, the values of human rights, egalitarianism to an extent, I don't want to exaggerate that because it's certainly not egalitarianism for everybody, but a leveling of express class hierarchies, the clothing changes along with it. And there's lots of examples of the abandonment of finery, of powdered wigs, of trousers with stockings. All of these signify old world aristocracy and the something that looks more like the modern suit signifies modernity, rationality, progress, industriousness, civic virtue. But ultimately, that evolves into what we now understand as the three-piece suit or the standard business suit.
So one aspect of this evolution that I want to make sure we don't accidentally gloss over is color. Because, of course, if we go back and think to the mental image of the ruffs and the trunks and the whatever, our image and certainly the actual historical texts and documents and paintings show us that men wore a lot of colors.
Yes.
And yet, when we think of the three-piece suit, we have a much narrower palette that we tend to draw from. And so as part of this evolution in the sort of types of clothes and the ideas behind it that you've very helpfully just described, these are part of, in a lot of senses, a kind of bigger thing that in the book you call the great masculine renunciation, which is a fabulous term. So what is this? And particularly, why is it the masculine renunciation?
Yes, great question. So the great masculine renunciation occurs as men start to cast off this more elaborate, sumptuous, showy attire in favor of streamlined and sober attire. So, you know, lots of things are going on, but to kind of encapsulate it, you have this shift in values in which men no longer want, elite men, no longer want to express their elite status in terms of conspicuous finery. And that includes color, to be sure. So you're moving towards blacks, grays, a sober palette. All of this is reflecting this idea that masculine attire is practical. It's about dressing appropriately for the occasion without showing off. Now, all of that is indeed a masculine renunciation. So men are expressing these new values. And I want to emphasize that although the great masculine renunciation appears to be a renunciation of luxury, it's actually not. That in fact, elite clothing is equally luxurious, but in a much different way. It's a modern, modernized silhouette, and it's one where all of the elaborate detail is hidden. It's in details of construction. It's in refinement of fabric. There's a lot going on in a men's suit in order to give it the silhouette that it has, but it's not showy. It's not adornments on the outside. It's hidden on the inside. And so you're getting the streamlined modern silhouette. That's only true for men. Women, on the other hand, continue to express status in the way that both sexes had originally through sumptuousness, elaborate clothing, finery, clothing that's often in many ways physically constraining, and that's part of the point. You'll see women's clothing certainly makes a lot of reflects a lot of changes. But just for an example, in the Regency period in England, there's a big neoclassical revival. And what you get for women is a certain type of streamlined clothing, but it's a replication of a Greco-Roman gown. So there's something that's quite fanciful, quite whimsical about the woman's version of neoclassical clothing. The men's version doesn't look like an updated version of Greco-Roman clothing. Instead, it copies the silhouette of a Greco-Roman statue in a modernized garment. So men are expressing the future and modernity, and their version of neoclassicalism is about the silhouette of the heroic Greco-Roman male form, but it's not a throwback. Women's clothing is a throwback. And the consequence of that is that in every respect, male attire signifies civic virtue, responsible behavior, rationality, industriousness, all the things that you want in leadership, whereas women's clothing signifies status through sumptuousness, vanity, adornment, frivolity, whimsy, things that you wouldn't want in a leader. So the great masculine renunciation is very much about a change in the way social status is signified. But one thing that it does is it arguably widens the divide between the sexes. It makes it harder symbolically for women to seem to be politically competent. That wasn't true in Queen Elizabeth's era, for instance. But it is in the early 1800s.
And so a specific piece of that then, how do high heels go from being Louis the Sun King's favored kind of shoe to being exclusively for women?
Yeah, that's one of the interesting evolutions. So One thing that we notice until the period of the Great Masculine Renunciation, you know, the mid-1700s, all of the biggest advances, the most fashionable styles, the sexiest styles are masculine styles. And women tend to follow. They copy little pieces of masculine style. But just, you know, a really easy example is that men wear tights and trousers. Women remain draped below the waist until the early 20th century. It's just almost mandatory women's attire is to be draped below the waist. So men are getting these new innovations. High heels are they're the footwear of Persian equestrians. It's a heel that's designed to lock into a stirrup. And when these Persian equestrians are introduced into Europe, they are virile. They're very sexy. And the men begin to copy that style. So it's a masculine style that expresses masculine power, martial power. But of course, over time, as fashion works, they become exaggerated. And so the high heels get larger. They're less functional. They're more symbolic. When you get to Louis the Sun King and his, you know, the famous portrait where he's wearing the bright red high heels, at that period of time, this becomes a powerful statement of aristocratic status, so much so that King Louis has to pass a decree that only people in his royal court are allowed to wear high heels with red high heels, because everyone's copying them at that point, you know, again, in this mode of status emulation. Now, over time, some women, fashion-forward women, daring women, begin to adopt elements of masculine fashion. How much they can get away with is always a negotiation, and it's tense. Women will be severely punished for wearing certain elements of masculine fashion, and this has been a consistent through line, but some women will get away with adopting small elements of masculine fashion, and over time, that will become mainstream feminine fashions. So you see this first in the context of the upper parts of women's garments, where they adopt tailored elements. That's borrowed from menswear, but then pretty soon you have tight bodices and tailored sleeves still draped below the waist. The women are also begin to adopt high heels. And over a period of time, they become more and more associated with femininity because they're associated with conspicuous assertions of status. So when the Great Masculine Renunciation begins to take hold, male high heels worn by men, are renounced in the same way that other forms of sumptuous, showy attire for men begin to be renounced. Brocades and silks and bright colors, as you mentioned before, all these things start to become associated with discredited old values and also with femininity.
And so men stop wearing them, which is such an odd thing to realize from the way that you've put it together. Again, we have these images that kind of, if we looked at them properly, we'd realize something had happened. But at least it took me reading this to go, oh, wait a second. Hang on, there's something happening here, and all of these pieces very much come together. And now, of course, we have the Louboutins, which are pretty much exactly what the Sun King was going on about, that are very much for women in a lot of senses.
Yes, absolutely. I can't imagine that Christian Louboutin wasn't inspired by that famous portrait of Louis the Sun King in his red heels, that just becomes a very powerful status symbol. Except now, of course, it's a symbol of feminine sexuality rather than masculine sexuality.
So when you talk about things like Louis had laws or rules saying, hey, don't all jump on my bandwagon. You know, these heels are for me. They're fancy. They're special. There were a lot of laws like this that you talk about in the book, regulating, going back to Tudor England. There seemed to be a lot of these laws then of what fabrics different people could wear and that sort of thing. Did people follow these rules? Was it effective?
Well, it was a mixed bag, I would say. From the late 1300s forward, you begin to see an explosion of sumptuary laws. And if you track the frequency with which these kinds of laws are passed, they really are passed at an accelerated rate through the early 1500s, let's say. Then they start to go into decline. And this is true not only in England, but all over Europe, France, Spain, and the independent cities of the Italian peninsula. Lots of laws and it passed at this accelerating pace. One thing that's happening is that the elites are trying to keep up with changing fashions. So a new fashion will emerge. It begins to express in a variety of things, but aristocratic status in particular. And then relatively well-off members of the common classes, again, skilled artisans, tradespeople, financiers, will adopt those fashions, and then there'll be a law trying to restrict their ability to wear them. But the fashions keep changing. People find, you know, creative ways around them. Certainly some people defy the law, but I wouldn't want anyone to go away with the impression that the laws were not enforced. They were enforced. There are examples, for instance, of people who have their clothing seized by the authorities. One person had his garments ripped. He wore what were called a pair of trunk hose, which are these puffy kind of trousers that you might associate with Sir Walter Raleigh, let's say. They were very fashionable in Tudor era England. And this hapless individual had, I should have mentioned that they were stuffed with lining so you could kind of puff them up, and they made an even more dramatic statement. And so this commoner who was wearing trunk hose that were considered to be outrageous and contrary to good order had his clothing cut and the linings ripped out. And then with the linings, the silk linings trailing behind him, he was marched through the streets of London as an example, and marched to his place of residence where the authorities searched and found other offending garments which were likewise cut and torn. So Queen Elizabeth, for instance, passed a decree that guards would be placed at the gates of cities with a list of people according to their social status, and they would check to see what they were wearing and make sure they were complying with the latest sumptuary laws. So they were taken seriously, and there were real criminal sanctions involved. There were monetary fines as well. Having said that, people found lots of ways to continue to use fashion in order to express what they wanted to. And I think two things were going on here. There was certainly an attempt of people to pass themselves off as aristocrats when they weren't. You know, the Florentine patriarch Cosimo de' Medici, for instance, once remarked that one can make a gentleman with 2 yards of red silk. So there was this concern that anyone who could afford the appropriate clothing could pass themselves off as a member of the aristocracy. And that happened. But in addition, and I think this was even more threatening to the power structure, what you had was an emergent bourgeois class that was using fashion in order to assert its own status and its own place in society. Many of these people who ran afoul of sumptuary laws weren't trying to pass themselves off as aristocrats. Instead, they were claiming for themselves the kind of recognition, the kind of esteem that had previously been reserved to members of the aristocracy. And ultimately, I think that was much more threatening to the social order than people trying to pass themselves off, because it was actually a challenge to the hierarchy itself. So these laws were enforced in a variety of ways. They were resisted in a variety of ways. And I'd also want to suggest that over time, formal legal sanctions were supplemented by and then ultimately replaced by more informal rules that nevertheless served the function of regulating what people could wear and assigning meaning to clothing. So you get lots of informal ideas about decent clothing that would regulate, in particular, what women could wear. Also, ideas about social status as expressed through subtlety. And there were lots of etiquette guides that emerged, let's say, in the 1800s and 1900s, describing the kind of clothing that a well-bred gentleman or a well-bred lady would wear. Those two I count as dress codes. They may not be enforced through the coercive power of government, but they were certainly enforced through social ostracism, through reputation.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you for kind of explaining that, because I think that's really important, that we may not have laws that look quite the same today, but this idea of dress codes, I mean, the title of the book, is certainly not only the raiding someone's house and slashing their clothing, as dramatic as that is. But on this idea of kind of challenging the status quo, before we get to the 21st century, there's one other bit of the historical bit I'd like to ask about, which is rational dress reform, which I'd only been aware of on the women's side. I hadn't really been aware that there was a men's side. So I was wondering if you could explain kind of what was this particular challenge to the status quo and why did it fail?
Yes, well, you know, as we were discussing, women's clothing was kind of, in a sense, stuck in the past. Men were getting this modernized, streamlined wardrobe, and women had a variety of changes in fashion, but all of which were defined by sumptuousness, flamboyant, and cumbersome attire. And women began to rebel against this. So there was a feminist movement on, you know, I write about it on both sides of the Atlantic, the United States and England, where women were resisting this kind of clothing in favor of what they described as rational dress. There was a rational dress society in England and in New England, in North America. Amelia Bloomer in the United States is probably the most famous figure for this, and she devised a type of women's clothing that was a sort of pants for women that were dubbed the Bloomers. There were manifestos written, there were conferences, there were newsletters, there were lots of activity around this. And indeed, the Bloomer became something of a popular fashion trend for a short period of time. But it was ridiculed out of existence. So what you saw in the popular press was, you know, at first some magazines tentatively embracing this new trend and saying, oh, that's sensible, or it might be a nice way for women to have more comfortable and practical clothing. But then a real backlash, a ferocious backlash, in which it was mocked and ridiculed, and you had people suggesting, well, next women will be smoking cigars and carrying canes, and, you know, the women will be proposing marriage to the men, and, you know, society will be turned upside down. And so it kind of got ridiculed out of existence. And women's clothing continued to evolve in very slow and tentative ways toward modernity. The first form of mass-produced women's clothing, you know, unlike the Brooks Brothers suit, for instance, was the cage crinoline, which was designed to kind of mimic the layers and layers of petticoats that women would wear in order to have puffed up draped clothing. So this was a steel cage that could be, you know, kind of draped by just a thin skin of fabric. Now, that's in one way an advance. It's less heavy and less cumbersome, but, you know, it still contains all of the symbolic messages of the older women's fashion. It's still cumbersome. It's not a great advance. So these feminist dress reform movements, when they were overtly political, it did fail. Now, I can give you an example of a women's dress reform movement that succeeded. And what's interesting is that we don't consider this to be a political movement. Instead, we consider it to be a fashion trend. And that's in the 1920s and the emergence of what we think of as flapper fashions. So the flappers, we now kind of imagine as frivolous jazz speakeasies in the United States, you know, Daisy Buchanan from The Great Gatsby. But in fact, the flapper style started with working class women. They were a racially and ethnically diverse group of women. They were suffragists. They were people who were demanding a practical, streamlined women's fashion that in some ways mirrored the changes that men got during the Great Masculine Renunciation. And these flapper fashions were the subjects of, again, a lot of ridicule, a lot of backlash, dress codes prohibiting the flapper fashions, all kinds of dire predictions about, again, the decline of civilization if women were allowed to wear these kind of streamlined, form-fitting clothing. Some people thought that they were scandalously sexy. One woman was called criminally attractive for wearing her flapper fashions and thought, you know, no man could be expected to resist the sexual temptation of a woman wearing a, you know, a slim skirt. And then other people said that they were ugly and masculine and that no woman wearing these fashions could hope to get a mate. So they were kind of inconsistent and contradictory criticisms, but they took hold. And ultimately, the flapper fashions were the first real successful reform of women's attire in a modern direction. But it wasn't an expressly political movement. Instead, it was more of an implicitly political movement.
Sneakiness, maybe, was the successful bit. And in some ways, I think that's very much kind of something we still have, this idea of what genders should be wearing. There's sort of the explicit stuff, but there's also a lot of change that happens without necessarily the kind of strict laws and written down policies. Yes. Though of course, those are very much in sort of flux and in tension. So bringing this up to the 21st century, how do you see both the sort of formal and informal dress codes we have now dealing with changing ideas of gender?
Yes. In today's environment, I think the challenge of the traditional gender binary in clothing and self-presentation is one of the more striking developments. And now, this isn't entirely new. Throughout history, certainly women traditionally borrowed lots of elements of masculine style, you know, since from the late Middle Ages forward. This is one of the ways that women's fashion had evolved in an era in which societies were quite dramatically dominated by men and masculine privilege. And in addition, there have been significant instances in which men's fashion have borrowed from women's. Not as many historically, but some. So when you look, for instance, in the late 20th century at what fashion historians describe as the Peacock Revolution, a period in the 1960s where men are wearing kind of more flamboyant clothing. They might be wearing shirts with ruffles. There's a certain kind of romantic look to men's fashions during that period of time. That's, in a sense, men borrowing from elements of women's fashion or elements that might be seen as feminine. But in today's environment, it's much more dramatic because you have two things going on. One, you have a reuse of quite obviously gendered garments and a recombination in ways that disrupt or complicate the gender binary. So men wearing skirts and other elements of or corsets, you know, other elements that had been for many many generations had been considered exclusively feminine garments. Men wearing high heels. Maybe that's kind of back to the future in a sense, but really quite obviously feminine clothing, but with no attempt to look feminine. Instead, it's just I'm a man wearing aspects of feminine clothing. That's new. And at the same time, you have a move toward what you might describe as gender neutral or a gender ambiguous clothing that could be worn by either gender or by people that identify with neither gender. And now, again, that's not entirely new, but I think it's taken on a much greater significance and it's being advanced in more domains and in a more kind of explicit and aggressive fashion in today's environment than ever before. So I think this complication of gender norms is a real change and one that's going to be exciting to watch moving forward.
Very exciting to watch, but probably also challenging in a lot of ways. And one way in particular that I'm really pleased you raised in the book is obviously yourself, a lot of people listening to this are in higher education. We have, in a lot of senses, an educational job, but also a pastoral job in some senses. Mm. And so we can't pretend that, well, I guess we could, but we probably shouldn't pretend that dress codes don't exist in today's world. That's probably not a great idea. How do we maybe as educators think about, how do we talk to our students about this?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think you're absolutely right to say that dress codes still exist. We still care about what people wear, although we express it in different ways. You know, I mean, in the academy, one dress code is the norm that fashion is trivial and that serious and high-minded people don't care about it. So very often, almost inevitably, when I would give a talk about this, there would be at least one person who would say, well, I don't know anything about fashion, but here's my question or here's my comment. But it was important for them to flag, first off, I don't know anything about it. I don't spend my time on this kind of trivial stuff. Now, that requires one to dress in a particular way, in a way that would signify that you don't care, and to avoid things that might look like you do care too much. And so that's really just the contemporary version of the great masculine renunciation. It's, you know, another way of saying serious, sober, practical, responsible, industrious people don't waste their time with fashion. So I think that's a dress code, and it's one that is particularly particularly challenging for women who are expected by longstanding social norms to care about how they look, to be fashionable just in order to be presentable, but also are in an environment in which the norm is to look like you don't care about fashion. So there's a gendered problem with respect to that. And one of the things I mentioned in the book are, you know, some female academics who were struggling with how to navigate that they were criticized for being too feminine or too girly, and, you know, when that was, to their mind, just presentable dress, but also women who'd be criticized for being too frumpy or not put together. So we've got all these dress codes even now. Now, how do you talk to your students about it? That's a real challenge, because in today's environment, it's very sensitive, and to to be seen to criticize what someone's wearing can be quite fraught. And yet, people will enter professional environments in which there are very important norms about dress and subtleties, things, subtleties of cut, subtleties of fit are really important. You know, I teach at a law school, and going into the legal profession, there's a really narrow range of appropriate attire that you can wear as a lawyer and be taken seriously. Now, it's changed over time, and in some way, those changes, which have made it more casual, have reduced or eliminated formal and explicit dress codes. In some way, those changes make it harder to know exactly what to wear, but the rules are still there. And there are a lot of ways that people can go wrong in what they're wearing. So I think it's a real challenge to navigate that. And it is a challenge for us as educators to talk to our students about what might be expected of them in the professional world without coming across as either snobbish or judgmental or sexist. All those are real challenges.
Yeah, or limiting their self-expression, right? That's another.
Yes, or limiting their self-expression, which is, you know, kind of a paramount value, even as at the same time that self-expression is always conditioned by a whole series of social norms and expectations.
Exactly. Well, and speaking of kind of what we do with the current dress codes and the self-expression side, I think it is time to come back to the modern fashion industry, as we mentioned earlier, because you make a really interesting argument that while we might have seen historically that sumptuary codes, dress codes, rules about who's meant to wear what, inhibited personal expression to a degree, you consider that today, in fact, a lot of our current dress codes, written or unwritten, ally with fashion rather than working against them. Take us through this.
Yes. Well, I mean, in a few ways. One development that really it did begin in the late Middle Ages, but is accelerated dramatically in recent years, is the relationship between fashion and individual expression. So fashion's always been allied with individualism, in my view, since the birth of fashion. It's been one of the great drivers of fashion has been the desire of individuals to express themselves through what they're wearing. At the same time, it was always in conversation with the use of fashion to express social status and group membership and things along these lines. In today's environment, I think there's not only a perceived right to self-expression, but almost a perceived obligation to individual self-expression. And so people are expected to look authentic in how they dress. And someone who instead looks contrived or slavishly adhering to some kind of formal dress code might be treated with some suspicion in a lot of environments. So there's this expectation that one is expressive through their clothing in some way. And that's quite tightly allied to changing fashion trends and the kind of dynamism of the fashion system, where people are always searching for something new because the kinds of clothing that can be both sufficiently idiosyncratic to express oneself, but also sufficiently familiar to communicate something, will pretty quickly get adopted by a lot of people. And when they're adopted by too many people, then they're not idiosyncratic anymore. And so you need to move to something new. So that's one way that our contemporary norms about dress are really allied to the fashion industry. I mean, another more straightforward way would be in thinking about the relationship between status and scarcity. Now, in the late Middle Ages and Renaissance, scarcity and status were tied to the objective cost of the garments. So imported garments, colors that were difficult to manufacture, precious metals and gems, these expressed high status because everyone understood that they were rare and expensive. The problem, of course, came about when people of different social statuses could begin to afford those things. And so the status communication was complicated. Now, in today's environment, you have mass production lots of things that can be produced relatively cheaply, fast fashion. One way that status continues to be expressed is through branding, trademarks. So one way that you know for certain that a particular garment is somewhat exclusive and somewhat expensive is if it carries the brand of a high fashion designer. And we know that not because it's inherently expensive to manufacture, it may or may not be, but because the law provides an exclusive right to use that mark to a particular brand. So you know if you see a Polo Pony on a polo shirt, that that's a Ralph Lauren shirt, and it can't have been that the person bought it for $10 at Target. They had to have bought it for $150 at a Ralph Lauren boutique. Similarly, with a handbag that has Louis Vuitton trademarks all over it. So these are new ways of fashion signifying status, and they are very much allied to the prestige of the fashion industry.
Thank you for explaining those linkages, because it's really interesting to kind of think about how that's changed, and especially this idea of looking authentic and looking idiosyncratic. We don't always think about kind of the structural forces behind that. But that kind of leads me to my penultimate question. Obviously, the title of the book is Dress Codes. We've talked about them restricting identity. We've talked about them in the most recent times, influencing sort of shopping habits and how people present themselves. Clearly, dress codes aren't going anywhere. So can we, and if so, how can we make better dress codes?
Yes, I think we can make better dress codes. And the first step, as you suggest, is that we recognize that dress codes aren't going anywhere. We recognize that fashion isn't trivial. It's important both for social significance and for individual expression. And that we do make judgments about people based on what they wear, even when we claim that we're not making judgments. And in fact, those judgments can be all the more powerful and all the more dangerous when they're unacknowledged. They can be more powerful because we don't even recognize why it is that we're making a particular judgment about an individual. And they can be more dangerous because we don't recognize the ways in which those judgments might reinforce social hierarchies and inequities that we otherwise would profess to oppose. So explicitness and self-awareness about dress codes would be a first step. You know, when people, for instance, in the Silicon Valley that often considers itself very woke, when they say, I don't care what people wear, I only care about, you know, the content of their coding. But here's, you know, example, Mark Zuckerberg wears a gray t-shirt, you know, it was kind of a famous part of his uniform. And that was seen as quite unassuming and expressing this ethos that we don't care about fashion and, you know, anything goes. But then he says, here's what he says. He says, the reason I wear a gray t-shirt is because wasting your time on things that are trivial like fashion dissipates your energy. And I wouldn't be doing my job as the CEO of Facebook if I wasted energy on that. Now, if you think about it, what does that say? Does that say we don't care about the gray t-shirt? Or does the gray t-shirt become a symbol of the work ethic and of a certain kind of industriousness? I think it's the latter. And if that's true, then there's a subtle judgment about anyone, for instance, who wears clothing that looks like they did spend time on trivial things. And sure enough, you see this taking hold, particularly in the case of women in Silicon Valley. So the Yahoo CEO, Marissa Mayer, wore a fashionable outfit in a Vogue magazine. She's just, you know, a fashionable woman who likes fashion. She gets a chance to be in Vogue magazine. Who wouldn't take it? So she does. And she's trashed in Silicon Valley. It's not that it doesn't matter. It's not that no one cares or that we're indifferent. Instead, they say, look at that. She looks like she's going out to a party or on vacation while everyone else is working. So it's those kind of subtle dress codes that I think we could do better about by being more explicit about why we might require a certain kind of self-presentation, because we do care about what those norms of professionalism and respectability look like, and to be aware of the way in which they could reinforce other hierarchies. How do women fit into our ideals about professionalism and the way people should dress? What about people of color who are often new to professions and are just entering? How about social class status? And in what ways do our norms reflect an assumption about the way people have been raised and about what they understand to be appropriate attire that may not extend to everybody? If we were more self-aware, I think we could do a better job.
I generally approve of more self-awareness, and I think there's some very clear reasons outlined there why it would be beneficial in this particular case. But before I let you go, I do have one final question. The book obviously came out in 2021. Is there anything you've been working on since, or working on now, or looking to work on in the future? Anything else that you're doing that you'd like to make our audience aware of?
Sure. I mean, I've been working on lots of things in the race relations space, but my big project now is what I'm tentatively calling the law of vice. And it's in line with my concerns about the way law regulates everyday life. But I want to look at the category of vices and vice crimes, you know, in particular, drugs and mind-altering substances, sex work and gambling, and how though that category of transgressions has been treated historically, why we've treated it that way. I'm at the beginning of the project, but what I can say is that my working hypothesis is that the regulations around vices, which dealt with the intimacies of everyday life, were prototypes for much broader types of regulations that have affected the development of increasingly urbanized and industrialized civilizations. And so looking at why we would regulate things that many people would describe as victimless crimes, what the importance was, what values were being expressed through regulating vices, and then also the techniques that were used to regulate vice and how those spread in other areas of society. That's a project I'm currently just beginning to work on. So, you know, it'll probably be another 5 years before the book comes out.
Well, it sounds fascinating. So when it does come out, we'll have to have you back to tell us all about it. But while you're working on that, listeners can read the book we've mainly been talking about, again, titled Dress Codes, How the Laws of Fashion Made History. Richard, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed our conversation.